Welcome to this audio edition of Philip Pusher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, December 12th through Saturday, the 14th, feature guest conductor Fabian Gabel and baritone soloist Constantine Kremel. The program includes 4 C interludes from Benjamin Britten's opera, Peter Grimes, 4 of the Songs of a Wayfarer by Gustav Mahler, The Tempest by Tchaikovsky, and a suite from the Eric Wolfgang Korngold score for The Seahawk. Here are Philip Pusher's program notes on the 4 C interludes from Benjamin Britten's Peter Grimes. The performance time, around 16 minutes. Britten set Peter Grimes, his first major opera, in a small fishing village that could easily be the seaside town of Aldborough in Suffolk, which he helped to make famous. Britten was born some 20 miles up the coast from Aldborough, and he eventually established his own music festival there. The sea is a powerful presence in Peter Grimes. It dominates Britten's characters just as it has controlled life in Aldborough. Of the 5 streets that once ran parallel to the coastline, 2 are now submerged. As the final curtain falls, even the individual tragedy of Peter Grimes is washed away by the great ceaseless tide. In the orchestral interludes which divide the scenes of Peter Grimes, Britten has painted the sea in all its terrific splendor, the phrase of George Crabbe, the Aldborough poet, whose The Borough was the inspiration for Britten's opera. The interludes depict more than scenery. In them, we sense the plight of an outsider in an unsympathetic society. He lived from all mankind apart, Crabbe writes of Grimes, and the painful alienation that lies at the heart of all Britten's work. Here's the synopsis of the opera Britten provided for the opening night audience. In the life of his Suffolk fishing village, Peter Grimes fits uneasily. He lives alone, visionary, ambitious, impetuous, poaching and fishing without caution or care for consequences, and with only one friend in town, the widowed schoolmistress Ellen Orford. He is determined to make enough money to ask her to marry him, though too proud to ask her till he has lived down his unpopularity and remedied his poverty. He fishes with the aid of an apprentice, bought according to the custom of the time, from the workhouse. In the prologue, he is chief witness in an inquest on his first apprentice, and the verdict is accidental death. In Act I, he is boycotted, but obtains a second apprentice, whom Ellen goes to fetch for him and promises to care for. In Act II, she discovers he has been using the boy cruelly. Led by a rector, the men of the borough go to investigate his hut. Frightened, Peter takes the boy down the scar of a recent landslide under which he moors his boat, and the boy falls down the cliff. When it is discovered that the boy is dead, a hue and cry from the borough sets out to find Peter, who commits suicide by scuttling his boat just out of sight of the town. This is in the small hours of the morning. The borough wakes up and goes on with its life as usual. Britten's interludes are distinct from the rest of the opera. They are to be played with the curtain down, yet they're indispensable to its meaning and impact. In that sense, they're like the prose poems with which Virginia Woolf introduces each section of her novel, The Waves. After the triumphant premiere of Peter Grimes on June 7, 1945, Britten realized that the interludes could stand alone as evocative sea pictures, and he selected 4 to be played as a suite. The first, Dawn, links the prologue and the first scene of Act I, which opens on a street by the sea. Britten's music is both beautiful and terrifying. It suggests the powerful paintings by J.M.W. Turner, the great English artist of the 19th century, who bought several houses so that he could watch the sun rise over the sea from different vantage points. The interlude opens with a clear, high theme, like the fine line dividing the water and the sky at dawn. Clarinets and harp arpeggios suggest the spray of the waves, while quiet chords in the brass and low strings hint of a terrible undercurrent, even in the warming glow of dawn. This music returns at the opera's end to start another day oblivious to Grimes' suicide. Aldborough is in Constable County, And in the second interlude, Sunday Morning, it's easy to picture a lone church steeple against the wide sky. This is the music that opens Act Two. Villagers hurry through town on their way to church. The sea sparkles in the sun. Four horns in pairs sound the ringing of the bells. They're later joined by actual bells. Soon, the streets are empty. A cloud seems to have covered the sun. The final act of the opera opens in the calm of night with the moon shining over still waters. Moonlight, the third interlude, depicts not only the sea's repose and in the harp and flutes the glimmer of the moon on the waves, but also its underlying menace. The fourth interlude, Storm, links the two scenes of Act One. Alone, watching fierce clouds approach over the sea, Peter sings, "What harbor shelters peace away from tidal waves, away from storms? What harbor can embrace terrors and tragedies? With her, there'll be no quarrels. With her, the mood will stay. Her breast is harbor, too, where night is turned to day." The storm breaks, and the music rises to a terrible climax. It finally subsides in slow phrases of eerie calm, but Grimes' equilibrium is upset, and he soon comes to realize that his dreams are beyond his reach. Program notes by Philip Huscher on the 4C interludes from Benjamin Britten's opera Peter Grimes. And now on to a symphonic fantasia after Shakespeare, The Tempest by Tchaikovsky, the performance time around 26 minutes. It was the power of Shakespeare that helped Tchaikovsky to find his voice as a composer, first in Romeo and Juliet, the fantasy overture composed in 1869, and then 4 years later in this grand and sweeping symphonic fantasia inspired by The Tempest. The idea for writing music based on The Tempest came from Vladimir Stasov, the powerful but often prickly Russian critic. Stasov was with Tchaikovsky at the Rimsky-Korsakov's for Christmas in 1872, and he was so taken with Tchaikovsky's piano rendition of his new Little Russian symphony that he asked what the composer had planned for his next work. When Tchaikovsky vacillated, Stasov intervened, as he regularly did with artists he favored. In a letter a few days later, he suggested three subjects worthy of musical treatment: Gogol's novel Taras Bulba, Scott's Ivanhoe, and The Tempest. Having succeeded with Shakespeare in the past, Tchaikovsky did not hesitate to try again. Stasov outlined a Tempest scenario for Tchaikovsky, but although the composer agreed to the blueprint, he put off starting work immediately. One of his first quandaries, in fact, was whether there needed to be a Tempest in The Tempest, and if so, where should he put it, at the start or in the middle? And if not, should he call the work Miranda instead after the play's captivating heroine? Is it essential to depict the fury of elements in an overture written on a piece where this incidental circumstance serves simply as the point of departure for all the dramatic action, he asked. Stasov's reply was swift and unequivocal. Of course there must be, he fired back, and he suggested representing the sea twice, at the beginning and at the end. He also recommended that the storm itself should erupt in a flash and at full strength, unlike storms in nature, to show that it was created by supernatural forces. "Let your storm suddenly take hold and howl," he wrote. Still, Tchaikovsky hesitated, claiming, in the words of a true procrastinator, that he preferred to wait for exactly the right moment to begin. But begin he finally did. He finished the rough draft in August, evidently after 2 weeks of solid work in the peaceful countryside, as if moved by some supernatural force. The score was ready for performance by early December. As with Romeo and Juliet, The Tempest is a highly selective reading of Shakespeare's drama. Stasov's original outline was succinct: the sea, Ariel, spirit of the air, raising a tempest at the bidding of the magician Prospero, Ferdinand's ship sinks, the enchanted island, the first shy awakening of love between Miranda and Ferdinand, Ariel, Caliban, the young couple's love grows to overwhelming passion, Prospero renounces his magic powers and quits the island, the sea. From this, Tchaikovsky crafted a piece in arch form, a series of linked episodes of varying weight and drama. He opens with the sea, placid and luminous at first, and then with the roll of the timpani surging with violence and unexpected power as the magician Prospero raises the tempest. The emotional heart of the piece, although not the capstone of the arch, is the expansive and lyrical music for the lovers Miranda and Ferdinand. Brilliantly colored shorthand portraits of the spirit Ariel, fleet and fantastic, and the monstrous Caliban, crude and blundering, sit at the center of the score. But the love music returns as if it has never been interrupted, and it is even more impassioned and yearning. At the climax, Tchaikovsky writes four Fs, quadruple forte, for the first time in his music. Prospero then renounces his magic powers, and we are left once again with the sounds of the sea fading towards silence with distant, happy Italy just beyond the horizon. Program notes by Philip Huscher on The Tempest by Tchaikovsky. And now on to a suite from the Eric Wolfgang Korngold score for The Seahawk, the performance time around 18 minutes. It could be argued that Eric Korngold was destined to compose music. He was aided by a father who gave him Wolfgang as a middle name, and as Vienna's leading music critic, could ensure his son what no other composer in history could boast, one good review for each new work. Eric caused a sensation at an even younger age than the precocious Mendelssohn a century before. In 1907, at the age of 10, he played through his cantata Gold at the piano for Mahler, who called him a genius. His fame was secure at 13 when the Vienna Court Opera produced his ballet, The Snowman. The Munich Court Opera produced two one-act operas he composed at 16. One's first reaction, Richard Strauss later wrote, upon learning that these compositions are by an adolescent boy, is of awe and fear. This firmness of style, mastery of form, individuality of expression and harmony is truly amazing. With the opera, he composed at the age of 20, Die Tote Stadt, The Dead City, which enjoyed extraordinary popularity through the 1920s, it appeared that, like Mozart or Mendelssohn, Korngold might actually sustain the remarkable success of his youth. Although Korngold's status in the music world remained high, a Vienna newspaper poll in 1932 ranked him and Arnold Schoenberg as the two greatest living composers. His career did not turn out the way his early champions would have guessed. In October 1934, the director, Max Reinhardt, sent Korngold a telegram inviting him to Hollywood to adapt Mendelssohn's incidental music to A Midsummer Night's Dream for a new film version. Korngold accepted, and although he planned to work there for 6 weeks, he signed on with Warner Brothers and ended up staying until May 1935. His first assignment was to write music for Captain Blood, which made Errol Flynn a star. Beginning that year, he divided his time between Los Angeles and Vienna, and then, with the Anschluss in 1938, he moved his family, including his parents and brother, to Hollywood. He became a U.S. citizen in 1943. Korngold's film work was an unexpected departure from the Mozartian career for which he had seemed destined, and it brought him new fame. He won Academy Awards for scoring Anthony Adverse and The Adventures of Robin Hood, and nominations for The Private Lives of Elizabeth and Essex and The Seahawk. His last film was Deception, with Betty Davis playing Beethoven's Appassionata Sonata. Korngold himself was the pianist, and Paul Henreid performing Korngold's own cello concerto, actually played by Eleanor Aller, Leonard Slatkin's mother. During his Hollywood years, Korngold devoted himself to writing for the movies. It was as if he had taken a vow not to compose a single note outside the genre of film music for as long as the horror of World War II was raging throughout the world, his wife, Lucy, later suggested. The Seahawk, Korngold's 10th film score in 6 years, was the last music he wrote for Warner Brothers' blockbuster series of swashbuckler movies starring Flynn. In The Seahawk, Flynn is a privateer in the service of Queen Elizabeth I when King Philip II of Spain sets out to conquer the world with the launch of the Spanish Armada in 1588. Korngold scored all but 20 of the film's 126 minutes. He had just 7 weeks to compose the music because of the tight deadline. He was assisted by 4 orchestrators. The score is the crowning achievement of this unexpected chapter in his career, a complex, almost symphonic interweaving of themes that perfectly capture character and brilliantly convey the dramatic situation. Korngold was said to have the uncanny ability of watching a scene once and then going off to write music that fit it precisely. The original soundtrack was not released at the time. That was not yet common practice, particularly for a score of such length and complexity. Korngold made an orchestral suite from the full film score that was reconstructed in 2003 by Patrick Russ, who has worked on orchestrating scores for many films, including Dead Poets Society and Ghostbusters. It begins with a grand swashbuckler of a theme that represents the Errol Flynn character. What follows is music of pageantry and adventure, romance and battle, the Elizabethan court, and the jungles of Panama. It's all interwoven seamlessly into music so symphonically built that it does not betray its origins in Hollywood, and so colorful and pictorial that even without its visual counterpart, it is quintessentially cinematic. Program notes by Philip Huscher on A Suite from The Seahawk by Korngold. I'm Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.